from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We cannot continue down this catastrophic path. And so we say to the president, Mr. President, we need a new direction in Iraq.
Nancy Pelosi becomes the first female Speaker of the House. We'll look at the rise of the San Francisco Liberal. African Americans head more congressional committees than any time in history. We'll talk with Professor Ron Walters. Then thousands of Zapatistas and their supporters gathered in Chiapas. We'll get the latest report. And finally, after almost 2 years in a Haitian prison, folk singer Soan joins us live in studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Congress reconvenes today with Democrats in control of both chambers for the first time in 12 years. On Wednesday, President Bush welcomed incoming lawmakers after meeting cabinet members at the White House.
I welcome their arrival into town. I'm looking forward to working with them. And so are members of my cabinet. We've all been entrusted with public office at a momentous time in our nation's history. And together we have important things to do. It's time to set aside politics and focus on the future.
Democratic leaders say they'll prioritize congressional ethics reform and raising the minimum wage. This is Democratic Majority Leader Steny Hoyer.
We're going to bring the minimum wage up so that people in the richest nation on the face of the earth aren't working 40 hours and living in poverty. We're going to make sure that families can afford college expenses and that they're young people can afford college expenses so we can remain competitive.
As the Democrats push their domestic agenda, peace activists convened on the Hill Wednesday to call on new Congress to end the Iraq war. Illinois Congressmember Rahm Emanuel held a news conference Wednesday on ethics regulations when he was interrupted by a group led by peace activist Cindy Sheehan.
Okay. At every
stage.
We're going to keep going here.
Troops home now.
We're going to have a...
The peace activists chanted, "Troops home now." We'll have more on the new Congress after headlines. In Iraq, the Iraqi government has arrested a guard accused of filming Saddam Hussein's execution. Widely circulated video shows guards and witnesses taunting Saddam Hussein just minutes before his death. At the White House, Press Secretary Tony Snow dismissed calls to join international condemnation of Saddam Hussein's execution.
And I think we leave it at that. But the one thing you got to keep in mind is he got justice. This is a man who killed hundreds of thousands and was executed for it according to the laws of the country and in accordance with legal traditions that have met international scrutiny.
Saddam Hussein was executed Saturday for ordering the killing of more than 100 villagers in the town of Dujail in 1982. Critics say the Bush administration helped encourage the rush to execute Saddam Hussein without trying him for his worst atrocities committed with U.S. support. In the occupied territories, at least 5 Palestinians were killed Wednesday in new clashes between Fatah and Hamas. It was the worst day of violence since the 2 main Palestinian factions agreed to a truce last month. Meanwhile, friends and colleagues of a Peruvian photographer kidnapped in Gaza this week have launched a new appeal for his safe release. Jaime Rzuri was seized by gunmen after he returned from an assignment. He works for Agence France-Presse. Family members and friends held a news conference Wednesday in Peru. In Gaza, Agence France-Presse manager Sakhar Abu El-Awan said Rzuri's life could be in danger.
We are worried about his life, about his health. He's sick. He has many health problems, heart problem, and stomach problem. We call for urgent release for him.
Meanwhile, in Israel, an Israeli peace activist imprisoned for aiding a Palestinian militant has been released from jail. Tali Fahima had served more than 2 years of her 3-year sentence for aiding Zakaria Zubaydi, the head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Jenin. As part of her conditions for early release, Fahima will be barred from visiting the occupied territories. As she emerged from jail Wednesday, she said, quote, "I don't regret anything. I will continue to work against the occupation and for peace." Back in the United States, former President Gerald Ford was laid to rest Wednesday at a funeral service in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Former President Jimmy Carter was among those who spoke.
For myself and for our nation, I want to thank my predecessor for all he has done to heal our land. Those were the first words I spoke as president. And I still hate to admit that they received more applause than any other words in my inaugural address. You learn a lot about a man when you run against him for president, and when you stand in his shoes and assume the responsibilities that he has borne so well.
In voting news, the New York Times is reporting the laboratory responsible for testing most of the nation's electronic voting systems has been barred from approving new machines after election officials concluded it hasn't kept proper records. The company, Cyber Inc. of Colorado, is the largest tester of voting machine software in the United States. Experts say Cyber's lax procedures could mean many current machines were not properly tested for crucial features like vote counting software and security against hacking. Ariel Rubin, a computer science professor at Johns Hopkins, said, quote, "What's scary is that we've been using systems in elections that Cyber had certified. This calls into question those systems that they tested." In news from Washington, National Intelligence Director John Negroponte is reportedly set to resign to become Deputy Secretary of State. Negroponte has overseen the nation's 15 spy agencies since his appointment in April 2005. His career includes stints as ambassador to Iraq after the U.S. invasion, ambassador to Honduras, where he played a major role in the U.S. efforts to topple the Nicaraguan government. Former National Security Agency Director Navy Admiral John McConnell is expected to be named Negroponte's replacement. In Washington State, a 17-year-old student was killed Wednesday in a shooting at a Tacoma high school. Police have arrested an 18-year-old suspect, also a student at the school. In environmental news, the British government's Weather and Climate Change Office is already predicting 2007 will be the warmest year on record. A Met Office spokesperson says the forecast is based mostly on greenhouse gas emissions caused by human activity and the residual effects of the 1998 El Nino storm. Meanwhile, the oil giant ExxonMobil is again being accused of funneling millions of dollars towards public campaigns to discredit the science behind global warming. On Wednesday, the Union of Concerned Scientists said Exxon gave $16 million to more than 40 groups over a 7-year period. The group says Exxon used the money to help create a false debate to prevent governments from curbing global warming caused by human activity. In other news, the television network CNN has apologized to Illinois Democratic Senator Barack Obama over a graphic that mistakenly listed Osama bin Laden's first name as Obama. The mistake came in a preview for a segment on bin Laden that read, quote, "Where's Obama?" The incident is one of several that have raised questions about the media's coverage of Obama as he mulls a possible presidential campaign. Pundits have begun highlighting Obama's middle name, Hussein, as a potential political liability. And last month on CNN, senior analyst Jeff Greenfield compared Obama's style of dress to that of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And finally, newly released FBI documents reveal both the Nixon and Reagan administrations ordered the monitoring of witnesses set to provide critical testimony about former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. In 1971, the Nixon White House ordered the FBI to run background checks on witnesses in Rehnquist's initial Senate confirmation hearing. When Rehnquist was nominated to Chief Justice 15 years later, the Reagan administration told the FBI to check on the witnesses and find out what they planned to say. The witnesses were going to discuss voter suppression, specifically minority voter suppression and Rehnquist's involvement in it as an attorney in Arizona. The FBI obtained the names from then-Assistant Attorney General John Bolton. Bolton was the Bush administration's U.N. ambassador until last month. The documents also show the FBI was aware in 1971 Rehnquist owned a home in Phoenix that was only allowed to be sold to whites. The clause was only disclosed 15 years later, and Rehnquist claimed he was unaware. The new files also reveal details of Rehnquist's dependency on prescription painkillers. In 1981, doctors reported Rehnquist exhibited severe withdrawal after he stopped receiving the medication. Rehnquist was said to have tried to escape from a hospital stay in his pajamas after convincing himself of a CIA plot against his life. The FBI has withheld an additional 200 pages in Rehnquist's file and says one entire section cannot be retrieved. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. On Capitol Hill, Congress reconvenes today with Democrats in control of both chambers for the first time in 12 years. In the House, Democrats are set to officially elect Nancy Pelosi to be House Speaker. Pelosi is to become the first woman ever to run the House, as well as the first Californian and the first Italian-American to be Speaker. Pelosi has represented San Francisco since 1987. She comes from a family with deep ties to the Democratic Party. Both her father and brother served as the mayors of Baltimore. She is also one of the wealthiest members of the House.
Nancy Pelosi has already outlined an ambitious plan for the Democrats' first 100 hours in power. She wants to increase the minimum wage, strengthen ethics rules, allow the federal government to negotiate prescription drug prices for Medicare recipients, increase federal support for stem cell research, ban gifts from lobbyists, and clamp down on travel funded by private interests. In order to push the agenda, Pelosi has vowed to bypass House committees and move legislation directly to the floor in an effort to limit the ability of Republicans to make changes. In November, hours after the Democrats seized control of the House, Pelosi also vowed to challenge President Bush's Iraq strategy.
The American people voted to restore integrity and honesty in Washington, D.C. And the Democrats intend to lead the most honest, most open, and most ethical Congress in history. The American people voted for a new direction for a fairer economy. And Democrats intend to work for an economy where all Americans participate in the prosperity of our great country. And nowhere did the American people make it more clear that we need a new direction than in the war in Iraq. Stay the course has not made our country safer, has not honored our commitment to our troops, and has not made the region more stable. We cannot continue down this catastrophic path. And so we say to the President, Mr. President, we need a new direction in Iraq.
Nancy Pelosi speaking on election night last November. Mark Sandalow is on the phone, is in Washington with us. He is the Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Chronicle, has closely covered Nancy Pelosi's political career for years. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Let's start with how Nancy Pelosi came to this position today, where she becomes the first female Speaker of the House.
You know, Nancy Pelosi didn't even run for political office until she was 47 years old. That was almost 20 years ago. She had five kids in 6 years and spent most of her time working on behalf of the Democratic Party as a fundraiser, as a behind-the-scenes volunteer, and raising her kids. When her last kid was a senior in high school, she likes to tell the story about how she went to her and said, you know, sweetie, I've got an opportunity here to run for Congress, but you're still in high school. If you don't want me to do it, I'm not invested in it. I don't have to do it. And as she quotes her daughter saying to her, daughter looked up at her, 16 years old, and said, Mom, get a life. So Nancy Pelosi runs for office in San Francisco. She had replaced a congresswoman who had died in the middle of her term, Sally Burton. She won a very, very heated special election in San Francisco, and she hasn't had a close election, re-election to Congress ever since. By the time she got to Washington, because of her involvement in politics, because of her father and her family's roots, she was raised in Baltimore, where her father was first a member of Congress and then the mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was mayor of Baltimore. She had been involved in Democratic Party politics. By the time she first walked on the House floor in 1987, she says she knew already about 200 members by first name. So this was a woman of the institution. She came to Congress pushing for things that are, you know, that now seem antiquated. She was pushing for federal money for a disease that wasn't even being talked about on the federal level, and that was AIDS. But AIDS was ravaging part of her San Francisco community. She fought for more money for AIDS. She fought for human rights in China. It was really not until she'd been in Congress a good 10 years that the idea of going into the leadership of the party even came up. But once she decided that she wanted to jump into leadership, and that was in the late 1990s, she did it with the typical Pelosi 24-hour-a-day style. She's a woman who raises an enormous amount of money. She puts in incredibly long hours. And people turn on the television, and sometimes they see this wide-eyed San Francisco liberal. And by any definition, she is a San Francisco liberal. But it misses what has led her to this place she's at now. The reason Nancy Pelosi will become speaker today is because she has been a very, very successful a tactician for the Democratic Party. She was chairwoman of the California Democratic Party back in the 1980s. She knows how to raise money. She knows how to put people in position to win elections. And if that means espousing liberal views when it's appropriate, she'll do that. If it means taking money she raises from liberal San Francisco and giving it to candidates who are far more conservative from her, who need to win election in Louisiana or in southern Indiana, she'll do that as well. So this is a very, very pragmatic politician who has been focused for the last 20, even 30 years on winning elections for the party.
But, Mark, now she has made this promise that within 100 hours, the Democrats will pass this gamut of reforms. And to do that, she's going to have to steamroller the Republican minority in a way that the Democrats had complained in the past. How will this be accomplished, and how will she be able to fulfill her promise to have new openness in Congress while at the same time getting this ambitious legislative agenda through?
Well, I don't think she can fulfill both. I mean, you're absolutely right. She made two promises. It was that 100-hour agenda that Amy read off some of the list, or increasing minimum wage and expanding stem cell research. She was very specific in the campaign about what she would do in the first 100 hours if Democrats won a majority. She also did make this vow, as you point out, to run the most open Congress in history, allowing the minority, in this case the Republicans, the right to offer amendments, to demand hearings, to make changes to legislation. What you can't push through the ambitious agenda she wants in 100 hours if you're going to allow open debate on the floor, if you're going to allow Republicans a chance to amend things. So for the first 100 hours, Democrats have said, we're going to stick to the legislative game plan. In a sense, she's going for accomplishments over accommodating the Republicans. This, of course, allows Republicans to scream fouls. They've already done this week in Washington, that here, out of the blocks, as her first step as Speaker, Nancy Pelosi is denying the minority, the Republicans, the very rights that she insisted she would give them during the election. But I think Pelosi was faced with either passing this slate of legislation or giving a more open process to the Republicans. And faced with that choice, it was pretty clear to most Democrats she went for the accomplishments.
And at the same time, she has also damped down the left wing of the Democratic Party over the issues of the Iraq War and over the issues of holding the Bush administration accountable, possible impeachment proceedings. How has this gone, and what will be the consequences of these decisions?
You know, people are always amazed that back in Washington, where Nancy Pelosi is viewed as a strident liberal, that back in San Francisco, It's the liberal wing of the party that has protested outside her office. It's the left wing of the party that has tried to disrupt a few of her town hall meetings with demands that she be more strident and more more in President Bush's face, in a sense. The package of legislation that's coming in this first 100 hours, they may all be substantive, they may be important, but none of these are going to be difficult for Democrats to embrace. All Democrats are in favor of cutting college tuition costs for students, increasing the ability for the federal government to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. These are things that the party can rally around, and probably 100% of them will vote for. What Pelosi has not embraced yet are some things which she favors personally, but doesn't necessarily think that the entire party will embrace. Universal health care for all Americans, and as you point out, perhaps the issue that was most important to voters in November, getting U.S. troops out of Iraq. Nancy Pelosi, from the very beginning, was a sharp critic of going to war. From the very, very beginning, as Dick Gephardt, who was the Democratic leader in the House, stood with President Bush to support going to war in Iraq, Nancy Pelosi said, no, this is the wrong thing to do. But once the war has begun, Pelosi has refused to do what some on the left want her to do, which is to lead an effort to simply cut off money to the executive branch to wage the war. You know, one way that if the House and the Senate disagree with the commander-in-chief of the war, one way they can flex their muscles is simply say to the Pentagon, we won't appropriate any money. You can't run a war without money. It's been suggested to Pelosi that if Bush doesn't listen to Congress, that's precisely what she ought to do. She's flatly refused to do that. I think there are a lot of Democrats, Pelosi included, who look back on what happened to the Democratic Party in Vietnam. And while academia, and indeed a lot of history, may smile on Democrats for being the party that said, out now first, politics did not smile on Democrats, and a lot of Democrats are well aware that when George McGovern called to pull the troops out of Vietnam, you know, he took a drubbing in the Electoral College. There are an awful lot of Democrats who oppose President Bush on the war, but are simply unwilling to cut off money or to do the extreme measures that would put the party in the position of being branded, in their mind, for maybe another generation, as being weak on defense. So we're going to see an awful lot of positioning on Iraq, and if the president, as it's been reported, suggests a surge of new troops in Iraq, I think you're going to hear a lot of screams and yells from the new Democratic majority on Capitol Hill. But when it comes to cutting off money to the Pentagon, Pelosi has said she won't do it.
And on the issue of possible impeachment hearings looks into the way that President Bush has handled intelligence matters and others, the threats by John Conyers, has she clamped down on Conyers and others who have who initially were talking about holding hearings?
She did. She says it's completely off the table. And what you have to remember is, on impeachment, there are two issues here. One is, Pelosi, I believe, thinks as a pragmatic issue, it gets you nowhere. President Bush has 2 years left in office. If you really were to hold impeachment hearings and vote on impeachment, that takes at least a year. So now we're talking about, even if it were successful, getting rid of a president in the final year in office in what would be a very, very divisive debate, and installing Dick Cheney as president of the United States. Doesn't accomplish much. But it raises a deeper issue, and that's while Pelosi and her constituents, the city of San Francisco in this last election, the Board of Supervisors has voted to impeach the president, the city residents voted in the last election that they favor taking steps to impeach the president. Her constituents are certainly in favor of throwing Bush out. But that said, Pelosi now is Speaker of the entire House. She's also the leader of the Democratic Party in the House from coast to coast. I think Pelosi's calculation is, even if the people of San Francisco like it, she's not going to win re-election in close districts in places like Indiana, in places like North Carolina, if the Congress spends their time, instead of doing things like raising minimum wage, going after the president of the United States. And it really speaks to the tugs on her from the ideological wings of the party on the one hand and the pragmatic pull on the other hand. And having covered Nancy Pelosi as long as I have, I think the one thing that people are going to learn about her as Speaker is she is far more pragmatic than she is ideological.
I guess the question will be, with making domestic issues first, whether people will allow that to go forward, as we saw with the protest with Rahm Emanuel trying to hold a news conference yesterday and being shouted down by peace activists chanting, troops home now.
Well, you're right about that, because next week the Democrats plan what will be one of the most ambitious weeks the House of Representatives have ever planned. In 4 days, they're going to raise the minimum wage. They're going to adopt the recommendations from the 9/11 Commission. They're going to expand money for stem cell research, and they're going to change the way the government deals with prescription drug negotiations. They vow they're going to vote on all of those. It's a remarkable week, but overshadowing all of that is likely to be a primetime speech by President Bush, where he's going to talk about adding troops into Baghdad. If that's true, this entire domestic agenda is overshadowed by something that's much more in the forefront of most Americans' minds with the war, and it'll be impossible for the Democratic majority, the new Democratic majority, not to deal with that. Now, what they've said they're going to do is they will protest. They will tell Bush this is not appropriate after the election. They will have what they call new oversight. Instead of simply giving money in appropriation bills, there will be oversight in terms of, you know, the money that's gone to Halliburton, maybe some accountability in terms of how we're rebuilding Iraq. But I think there's going to be a big clamor from, it's not just the left wing of the Democratic Party, but perhaps the center of the Democratic Party, saying, look, one of the reasons, maybe the reason, that Nancy Pelosi is running the House and that Harry Reid is running the Senate is out of frustration from the public. Democrats, some Republicans, and a number of independents on the war in Iraq. And if this party doesn't deal with that issue before 2008, then voters are going to say, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. So I think there's going to be enormous push for Democrats to do something. The problem that Pelosi faces is, while she might strongly favor simply pulling out of Iraq, and she supported the plan by John Murtha of Pennsylvania to do just that as soon as possible, she knows that she can't necessarily get a majority of her party to go along with her on this. So on these issues, I think that we will see much slower progress than on this 100-hour agenda, which begins today at noon.
Mark Sandel, I want to thank you very much for being with us. San Francisco Chronicle's Washington bureau chief has been covering Nancy Pelosi for years. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll be joined by Professor Ron Walters to talk about the ascendancy of the Congressional Black Caucus. Stay with us. Django Reinhardt here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The new Congress will elevate more black lawmakers to positions of power than ever before. Four African Americans are likely to head committees. Up to 20 are expected to lead subcommittees. African American lawmakers will have direct oversight on issues such as tax policy, homeland security, the legal system. In addition, the third-ranking House Democratic leader, Congress member James Clyburn, is African American, and the only black senator, Illinois Barack Obama, is a possible presidential candidate.
Longtime Democratic political consultant Donna Brazile recently commented that, quote, "2007 will mark the first time in U.S. history that African Americans will have a prominent seat at the table in helping to shape public policy in our nation." But black lawmakers are already facing pressure from the Democratic leadership to hold back on pushing an agenda sought by traditional party allies. This includes creating a commission for reparations for slavery, enacting legislation to restore voting rights for convicted felons, prohibiting racial profiling by police and customs officers, increasing compensation paid to people displaced by Hurricane Katrina, and laying the groundwork for impeachment proceedings against President Bush.
Yesterday, President Bush spoke about the new Congress at a press conference. He urged Democrats to set aside politics.
We've all been entrusted with public office at a momentous time in our nation's history. And together we have important things to do. It's time to set aside politics and focus on the future. I've been encouraged by the productive meetings that I've had with many of the new leaders of Congress, of people from both parties. I want to thank them for coming down to the White House and talking to me about their ambitions and their goals for our country. I'm hopeful that Republicans and Democrats can find common ground to serve our folks, to do our jobs, to be constructive for our country.
President Bush speaking yesterday. Ron Walters joins us now from Washington, D.C. He's director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland, author of many books. His most recent is Freedom Is Not Enough, Black Voters, Black Candidates, and American Presidential Politics. Ron Walters is chair of the advisory committee of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Walters.
Good to be with you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out the committee chairmanships that are now led by African Americans?
Well, the major committees, and I think you were right when you said that there would be up to 20, probably 14 subcommittees, but the major committees, Judiciary, John Conyers, Homeland Security, Benny Thompson, and you're going to have a House Administration, Juanita Miller and McDonnell, and there was almost a fourth, and that was Elsie Hastings.
Of course, there's also Charles Rangel, head of Ways.
Well, Charles Rangel's head of Ways and Means, and he shouldn't be left out because that's probably going to be the key committee in the Congress this term.
We were discussing with our previous guest how Nancy Pelosi has tried to crack down on some of these leaders, especially Conyers on Judiciary over the impeachment issue, and Charlie Rangel over his constant call for the return of the draft. Could you talk about that?
Well, this is a politics that really started in the election. You have to trace it back to the Blue Dog Democrats, the conservative wing of the Democratic Party in the House Democratic Caucus. And they were saying that, well, some of these chairs that are going to come on stream if the Democrats win are going to be very liberal, quote unquote. That began to resonate with the Republicans, who then sent out a series of letters saying that, yeah, some of these chairs are going to be too liberal. They're going to go after the president to impeach him. They're going to do this, that, and the other. In response to that, Nancy Pelosi then extracted some promises. One of them, for example, from John Conyers that he wouldn't go after the president and impeachment. Another from Charlie Rangel saying that he wouldn't roll back all of the tax cuts. So that politics was really sort of the politics of the election process. It's now become the politics of 2008. And so the irony here is that although African Americans played a very substantial role in the election of 2006 in particular, turning over the Senate to the Democratic Party, that sort of moderate politics now begins to threaten the kind of agenda that you just laid out.
Is there any likelihood, down that the new Congress will deal with what has to be the most scandalous activity that has gone on over the last few years affecting the African-American communities, a situation not only of Hurricane Katrina itself, but of the continuing scandal over how New Orleans has been treated, especially the black community there?
Well, it's possible. When you look at the agenda, the 100-day agenda that Nancy Pelosi sort of rolled out, what is glaringly missing on the part of many African Americans is Katrina. And that marks sort of a difference in the two agendas and the politics that might evolve with respect to these new chairs and the House Democratic leadership. But you do now have John Conyers, who is in place to look at sort of the electoral process there. There was a lot of energy focused on the election of the mayor of New Orleans in this last session. And a lot of organizations, of course, were involved in that. So he is there now to look at that. You've got Benny Thompson, whose state of Mississippi, of course, was damaged. He played a role in some of the meetings with the White House in trying to develop all sorts of resources for Mississippi. He's now head of Homeland Security, where he'll be dealing with immigration issues, but also Gulf-related issues. So you now have at least two people, in addition to Representative Jefferson, who won re-election from that district, and who, although he may be considered to some tainted, nevertheless, he still remains a very effective member of Congress who has brought back a lot of resources to that area. So you have three people now who are going to press to see that those sort of issues are brought to the table.
In terms of the war in Iraq, and the members of the Black Caucus have been perhaps some of the most vocal on the issue of the war. What impact do you think, what will happen now with the new Congress?
Well, I don't know. You've got Barbara Lee, I think, has from Nancy Pelosi's area, has gained tremendous stature because she was the only member of the Congress to stand up and oppose this war. So obviously she will be exercising some leadership on this. But the big problem, of course, I see here is structural. When you look at the fact that already $436 billion has been spent the last session, the Republicans acted on another supplemental of $70 billion. That brings it up to $500 billion. And out there waiting in the wings somewhere in the Department of Defense is another $130 to $150 billion. Those kind of numbers make it very difficult for these new chairs to do very much for their constituency. So there's this supreme irony in all of this, that you have the most power that you've ever had in the Black community. And when you look at the political context within which they're governing, both on the fiscal side with respect to the funds going to Iraq and with respect to the moderation of the party, it looks as though that their power is going to be limited.
We're talking to Ron Walters, director of the African American Leadership Institute, University of Maryland, and is chair of the advisory committee of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. When you have someone like Congressmember John Conyers, who heads Judiciary, who made impeachment an absolute critical component of his agenda under Republican leadership, how do the politics work when he's just told to, well, as Nancy Pelosi said, take it off the table?
Well, his response was that he's going to hold hearings. And I think that he probably will come up as close as he can as the chairman to try to lay out the sort of way in which intelligence, for example, was used. You know, he was very active in pursuing sort of where the Downing Street memorandum led. So I think he'll do a lot to try to lay that out before the American people. I think that other things having to do with the use of intelligence, maybe in Vice President Cheney, of course, will come back into this. Scooter Libby will probably come back into this. So I think if he is active on sort of the hearings, oversight hearings, that are attendant to the way in which we got into the war, he may not have to call for impeachment, but he certainly can lay out a very damaging case that will continue to put the administration on the defensive. It looks as though, from what we're seeing here in pretend maybe next week, the president is going to lay out his agenda. Perhaps that's a surge of new troops, more spending, potential alienation of the American people, something that may last for another 2 years. If John Conyers is effective in these hearings, it seems to me that that is a politics that might take us again into 2008, that will continue to keep the American people focused on the war, focused on the way in which we got into this war, and therefore probably keep the Republican Party's negative ratings pretty high.
And the issue of voting, voter roll purges, particularly of African Americans around the country?
Well, that issue has a lot to do with the Federal Election Commission and the way in which it brings the technology on board to try to deal with many of these new sort of electronic systems that have been purchased with federal money. Again, another very ripe target for oversight, because when you look at the fact that right now in Florida, there is going to be a little bit of politics around a member of Congress who has just been elected, and in a situation where you've got 18,000 votes uncounted, Republican ostensibly won that election. The Democrats was the person who didn't have the 18,000 votes. There's a question of whether or not Democrats will vote not to seat that person. I think the Democrats probably would let the Republican be seated. But I think that a John Conyers will probably look into that and many other problems like that. He was very vigorous, as you know, in the 2004 election cycle, and looking into what happened in the election in Ohio, wrote a very stunning report on the disenfranchisement suffered there. And so I would expect that he would continue to do that now that he has the power to call oversight hearings.
And also, in terms of Congressman Charles Rangel, arguably the most powerful African-American in the history now of the Congress, heading Ways and Means, controlling the purse strings and essence of the nation, what do you see as the main things that he is going to press as chair of Ways and Means, and where will be the possible key differences that he might have with his own leadership and Nancy Pelosi?
Well, Representative Rangel said that tax reform will be his main target. Things like the alternative minimum tax, of course, involved in that. To the extent that he begins to deal seriously with taxes, particularly those taxes that were enacted by the Republican administration, he's going to run afoul of the White House. And depending upon what package he delivers, that could cause the president to exercise his first veto. But he's going to be active on other issues, trade issues, Social Security and Medicare, huge entitlement programs. And here is, again, as you know, the White House has tried to propose to the American people a different approach to the question of Social Security reform. I think that Charlie Rangel probably is going to go in another direction on that. Medicare spending, the same thing. So there are going to be these huge issues that are going to come before his committee that he's going to be probably at loggerheads with the White House, and that's going to have its own drama.
Ron Walters, I want to thank you very much for being with us, director of the African American Leadership Institute, University of Maryland, and chair of the Advisory Committee of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Haitian folk singer Soan, out of jail, in studio here. Stay with us.
Yeah.
So, Ann, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on PBS and, as well, public access TV stations in both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Haiti. On Monday, Haitians celebrated the 203rd anniversary of their country's independence. Over two centuries ago, on New Year's Day, 1804, Haiti became the first independent black republic and the only nation ever formed by a successful slave revolt.
It was almost two centuries later, in February of 2004, that Haiti's first democratically elected leader, after centuries of dictatorship, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup. Following Aristide's removal, the interim government began a brutal crackdown on supporters of his political party, Lavalas. Many people were jailed, exiled, or killed. Among those jailed was legendary Haitian folk singer and political activist Annette Auguste, also known as Soane. After more than 2 years in prison, Soane was finally released this past August. We spoke to her on Democracy Now! The day of her release. Today, Soane joins us here in the firehouse, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It is wonderful to have you with us. We are also joined by Kim Ives, who will help translate. Thanks so much for being here. How does it feel not only to be out of jail right now in Haiti, but to have come to the United States?
First, I thank you. And everybody who struggled with us to get us out of jail, I say thank you to them. Especially to Amy and Juan Gonzalez. Thank them a lot. Because I know all the work you've done for democracy. Thank you very much.
Can you describe the day you were arrested? What was the scene? Who arrested you? When was it?
The day they arrested me, it was the Marines who arrested me, U.S. Marines. It was a very dark day. It was with grenades they came into my house. The first grenade they threw blew off the head of my dog, which ended up in a tree. When they came, they said they were looking for guns, but they couldn't even find a big knife.
So
they arrested me. I was hoping they would have somebody to translate for me, but they didn't have anybody to translate. It was just Americans. America is a country that prunes democracy all the time. It's not their prerogative to come and arrest somebody without a warrant. They didn't just arrest me, they arrested everybody at my house, even a little 5-year-old kid. They put handcuffs on all of them. To arrest somebody like that with all your kids at home, it really traumatizes you. I think those were injustices.
You merited reparation.
And they should have reparations for
parce
that.
Que c'est pas possible pour entrer dans la caille au monde pour faire tout dégât ça yo et
pour bailler comme ça. It's not possible to come into somebody's house and do all that damage like that without reparations. They broke everything I had.
Sans preuve.
Without any proof at all.
And did they, once they jailed you, did they inform you of any charges? Did you ever go to trial on any charges? What happened during the period of your incarceration?
Bon, presque fait deux ans. Pas jamais allé
Two years.
Autre côté.
Nothing.
C'est juste à la fin. Bon, le prévalu président et puis bon décision qu'il prend.
At the end, when Provost became president, that a decision was taken.
Parce que monde qui était là avant, eux même ta remet comme si pour ta enterrer un plus fond.
Because the people who were there before, they wanted to bury me even deeper.
La tortue.
So there were no legal proceedings during the entire time you were in prison?
No.
Upon your release, what has been your situation, your personal situation in Haiti?
Situation
is even worse.
Parce que un monde qui t'a vivre normal la Cali.
A person living at their house
et
normally.
On sort la prison.
You leave prison.
Tout sorte gagné passé.
Everything you had is gone.
So, situation pas bon pour moi du tout, pas bon pour même moi qui me connais de tout.
And it's also not good for the people I used to help.
Can you talk about the position of those who support the ousted president Jean-Bertrand Aristide? Mm-hmm. Do you feel they are targeted today?
Bon. Jusqu'à présent, pas qu'on gagne rien changé vraiment.
Up until now, nothing has really changed.
Parce que si vous regardez, il y a René Civil qui est arrêté là.
If you look, there's a René Civil, another lot of activists who they just arrested. Vous pensez
que c'est toujours même bail qui a continué.
The same thing is continuing.
Parce que il y a un paquet de monde qui est en prison, moi-même pour considérer moi comme un monde qui libre.
A lot of people are still in prison. I don't consider myself
free. Parce que il y a un paquet de monde qui est arrêté dans la même condition avec moi jusqu'à présent qui est en prison toujours.
A lot of people who were arrested under the same conditions I was are still in prison.
Non, ça veut même pas monde qui peut parler pour eux. Nous même nous obligés de tourner la voix des sans voix pour être capable aider eux sortir de prison.
Those people don't have anybody to speak for them. I become the voice of the voiceless because they have nobody to speak for them.
Last week on the show, we had a segment on the recent massacre in Cité Soleil that involved United Nations peacekeepers or United Nations occupation troops there. What has been the role of the United Nations troops there, and how do you and other Haitians regard their presence in your country?
Bon, bagage ça pour moi-même, moi trouve que c'est une aberration que dit.
This is a real aberration, I think.
Parce que il est pas capable venir pour entrer en côté pour y tuer monde comme ça sans que pas gagne preuve de ce que monde en font bagage qui vraiment.
Because they can't come in and kill people like that without them having proof that the people are.
Parce que d'après on était là, le premier attaque la fête là le 24 depuis le 22.
I was there when the first attack happened on the 22nd. There was a they came in, there was a tank which was broken down. They thought that the tank was going to shoot on them, so they were very happy when it didn't, and they thought it was a gift to them. And they took apart the tank, and then they shot everybody for that. Yeah, all the children there, are those kidnappers? Those 60-year-old, 80-year-old people, are they kidnappers? They sent gas over everybody, and six people died the first day, poison gas.
I'm looking at a report that says, according to Pierre Alexis, the Haitian Red Cross coordinator in Cité Soleil, the UN soldiers prevented the Haitian Red Cross from treating children injured during the assault and stopped Red Cross ambulances from entering the area. This was in the attack of December
22nd.
They knew that if the Red Cross came in, they would see there were more people who had died, because that day more than 50 people died.
What do you think has to happen right now in Haiti, Soanne Auguste?
Haiti is a pays que moi qui occupé.
Haiti is a country which is occupied. Everything that happens, those are the people who are in front. Nations Unies? The United Nations troops are in front.
And in terms of the role of Préval, an ally of President Aristide for so long, why has he allowed this to go on?
pas fini de comprendre.
Pour qui ça Préval quitte ça ou les conserve si son son ami Aristide soi-disant.
Bon, son soi-disant ami.
He's a so-called friend. Of
Parce que si c'est Aristide qui est en position Préval, je pense que.
Because if Aristide were in Préval's position.
Il a fait tout ça possible et imaginable pour que Préval lui-même ait retourné dans le pays.
To make sure that Préval was
Parce
returned
que l'homme calculait tout le monde qui a tapé, c'est le monde qui était venu, qui était nommé comme. Combattant de la liberté, Guy Philippe,
When you look at all those people that they called the freedom fighters, people like Guy Philippe and other of the rebel leaders who have been terrible crimes.
Non seulement que yo prend pays là, yo même arrivé candidat à la présidence.
They not only have taken over the country, but they're even candidates for the presidency.
Alors peuple là même comme étant donné lui-même c'est lui qui est élu Aristide.
Since the people are those who are elected Aristide.
Alors si par exemple Aristide pas le pas senti Aristide dans Poyo, jusqu'à présent on t'a demandé pour retour Aristide.
If they didn't feel that Aristide was in their very skin. They wouldn't still be asking for Aristide's return.
Alors si tout assassin ça en Haïti pour que ça Aristide pas rentrer dans pays.
And with all those assassins in the country, why can't Aristide come back to his country?
Do you think President Aristide will return to Haiti from South Africa?
Haïti c'est pays président Aristide que lié.
Haiti is President Aristide's country.
N'a gomme jusqu'à ce que le retourne.
We're going to struggle until he gets back.
Do you think the US plays a large role in Haiti now. In 2004, when Aristide was ousted, he described to me when we followed the delegation of Maxine Waters, the congressmember from Los Angeles, and the founder of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson, when I followed them to Central African Republic and they took the Aristides back to Jamaica. He described that it was the number two man in the U.S. Embassy who went and told him that he could die, thousands of Haitians could die if he didn't leave. And then he was hustled onto this plane with U.S. military and security and sent off to, he didn't know where at the time, but it was the Central African Republic.
All those things were a way to have the monkey business go forward.
Yeah, parce que. En passant, from saluer Maxine Waters avec tout un congressman.
In passing, I want to salute Maxine Waters and all the congressmen.
Yeah, qui était bargoumé pour nous en pile.
Et puis fought for us a lot.
Yeah, n'a dit que président Aristide, son président qui élu constitutionnellement par le peuple.
President Aristide was a president elected constitutionally by the people.
Nous pas qu'à dire c'est Américain seulement qui était. Fait ma gouille ça pour président Aristide qui était payé parce que nous avons la France qui jouait un gros là-dedans avec le Canada.
We can't say it was just the Americans who were responsible for Aristide's being removed from Haiti. It was also the French who were involved.
Oui, parce que en question de restitution et réparation, nous avons demandé pour slavery, pour bagaille que nous passions en bas de la France.
Because we demanded restitution and reparations for slavery.
Alors c'est les paroles ça qui plus poussaient pour faire Aristide quitter le pays, parce que nous n'avons aucune raison pour ça.
This was the demand that really pushed them to kick Aristide out.
Your final statement to the American people.
Bon, je connais le peuple américain, son bon peuple lié.
I know that the American people are good people.
Même t'as pensé que l'établissement, Folta, Antigen, pas entrer trop dans bagage qui pas concerné, parce que eux-mêmes, ils ont
dit establishment shouldn't enter into things that don't concern them. U.S. establishment.
C'est le monde que y est, mais il faut que fassent bagage propre pour monde qui respecte eux, même gens qui ont respecté eux avant.
They have to do things correctly so people in the world will respect them the way they used to be respected.
Oui, parce que nous-mêmes nous dit peuple américain sont bon peuple lié parce que avec quand même chita là me connais que c'est avec américain m'a dit même connais mon ça c'est mais établissement son bagaille un bagaille réactionnaire net.
The US people are good people but the establishment is completely reactionary.
We're going to have to leave it there. So, Anne, thank you very much for joining us in our studio.
It's for me to thank you. Because you allowed me to say a couple of words in American.
So, Anne Auguste, very well known in Haiti, throughout the world, Haitian folk singer and political activist, jailed for more than 2 years in Haiti, recently released. Tomorrow we'll bring you our report from Chiapas. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Arne Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anne Nagura, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nagura, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Meg Megan Whitney, Hugh Grin, Jerome Bourgeois, John Randolph, Tyshawn Black, Uri Gallet, Samantha Chambly. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.